The Gemara Megillah tells us that Beschar Tznius Shaisa Berochel, in the merit of the Tznius, the modesty that Rochel showed, Zachsov Yotzim Min Shaul, she merited having Shaul. She was an extremely modest woman, showed great exemplary Tznius. Because of that, she merited having Shaul. And in the reward for the Tznius, Shaiyabot Mishol, and in reward for the Tznius that Shaul had, he was Zocha, he merited, and having Esther come from his lineage. And then the Gemara goes on to tell us what was the Tznius of Rochel and what was the Tznius of Shaul. The Gemara tells us that the Tznius of Rochel was really quite simple. Because Vayaged Yaakov the Rochel, when Rochel and Yaakov met at the well, Yaakov says, Ki achi avihu, I'm the brother of your father. Now the Gemara explains he wasn't the brother of her father. Yaakov was the son of Rivka, who was the sister of Lavan. He was not a brother to Lavan, he was a nephew. So why did he say, I'm a brother? Explains the Gemara, because really what he was saying was something particular. Yaakov met Rachel at the well, and he understood that this was his Bashert. According to the Medrash, they were Tanaim signed earlier, but in any case, he clearly knew that this was the one he was destined to bring the Jewish nation into existence through. This was his predestined person. And he said to her, will you marry me? She said, I would love to. But the problem is that my father is a Ramai. He's a devious trickster. What's the Ramayah, says Yaakov? The devious system is I have an older sister, and there's no way that he will allow me to get married before her. So he's going to trick you. He's going to fool you. Even though he'll say to you that he'll give you me in marriage, he's not going to actually do it. He's actually going to give my older sister. Says Yaakov, Achiv ani b'ramayis, I'm his brother in deviousness and trickery. And explains the Gemara, at that point Yaakov gave the simonim. Nida, chala, vadlokas, aner, the three main mitzvahs that a woman is to be careful in, that was the simon, that was the code, that if in fact Lavan were to try to swap someone else, if Lavan were to try to put somebody else in instead of Rachel, Yaakov would say, what's the password, what's the secret code? Obviously the woman wouldn't know the three mitzvahs, nida, chala, and lighting Shabbos candles, at which point she'd be found out to be a fraud. Yaakov and Rachel both knew that they had devised a foolproof plan. And in fact, for 7 years, Rachel waited. For 7 years, Yaakov waited. And the plan was foolproof, except for one little problem. What Yaakov didn't count on was Rachel. That evening, when she was to go to the chuppah, she saw something very, very frightening. She said, my sister is being taken. Lavan, in fact, was taking Leah, and Lavan said to Leah, you ought to go to the chuppah. And says Rachel, my sister is going to be embarrassed. Yaakov is going to say, what are the simonim? What's the password? She's not going to know it, and she's going to be horribly, horrifically embarrassed. And at that point, Rachel gave the simonim to Leah, and in fact, Vahi Babok of Leah, Yaakov got married. In the morning, it was Leah. What do you mean, in the morning it was Leah? Because that entire evening, he thought it was, in fact, Rachel. He asked for the simonim. She said the simonim, nida chalav adlakas. And there was only in the morning when he saw that it was not, in fact, Rachel, it was Leah. He realized he was duped. But up until that point, he thought, it was Rachel. So what is the tznius? Rashi explains. Because Rachel had another way out. You see, all Rachel had to do was to mention to enough people, make it public, that there was a passcode. If Rachel would have spread the word around, you know that Yaakov made a secret code with me, so I just want you to know that if anyone would try to swap another person in, you should just know it's not going to work because we have this secret code. If Rachel would have made that public, she probably didn't have the chutzpah to say it directly to her father, but if she told a few other people, the word would have passed around, Lavan would have gotten word. Lavan never would have therefore swapped in Leah. But Rachel didn't do that. Why didn't she do that? Explains Rashi, because it's tznius. It's not modest. A secret passcode between husband and wife, especially that has to do with inyoni tashmish, things of the private issues, It's not for public consumption. The world's not supposed to know about it. So Rachel realized that was not an option. There was only one option in front of her. Either she allows her sister to be embarrassed, or she gives the secret code. She said, I cannot stand the embarrassment. I cannot sit by and watch it happen. And she gave the code to her sister. And even though you see tremendous mesiras nefesh, you see what it means for a woman to give up everything, her husband, to be, instead of being the future of the Jewish nation, potentially she would have been married to Esav. She gave up everything. And while that's a tremendous lesson, the Gemara says there's another lesson to learn. And that is that she had certain principles, certain scruples. There was a sense of tznius. It's not proper. It's not modest for me to go telling the world about a secret code between husband and wife. She didn't reveal it to anyone else. And in reward for that, she merited having shol. She was such a tznua woman, such a modest woman, showed such decorum that she merited having shol. What was shol's tznius? So Gemara also tells us what the tznius modesty of shol was. Shmuel HaNavi was told by Hashem that you are to appoint a king. At a certain point, Shaul comes to Shmuel to ask a question, and Shmuel begins telling him that you are to be Negid, you are to be the king. He anoints Shaul as king, but at this point, no one knew it. Shaul went back. His uncle asked him, what did you ask the Ish Elokim? What did you ask Shmuel? And Shaul said, I asked about the donkeys. What did the Ish Elokim say? What did Shmuel say? He said that they're no longer lost, they're found. But that entire part, that Shaul had been anointed king in Yisrael, Shaul failed to mention. Why? Because he was truly a modest human being. That would have been bragging, it would have been showing off, it would have been, when the world has to know about it, the world has to know about it. But right now the world doesn't have to know, and Shaul was not going to tell anyone. And that truly is dramatic and incredible modesty. The ability to say, I don't need to brag, I don't want anyone to know, and for Shaul to keep it hidden from his uncle, keep it hidden from anyone, demonstrates tremendous modesty. And the Gemara tells us, because of this, Shaul merited having Esther. And this Gemara is really quite interesting, except for the fact that the pieces don't add up. Why? Because I understand tznius of Rachel. She showed tznius. It's not tznius to allow certain facts between husband and wife to get out. I understand that. I recognize that tznius. What does that have to do with Shaul HaMelech's modesty? It's not a lack of tznius. He wasn't undressed. He wasn't unclothed. It wasn't something to do with a private issue between husband and wife. What in the world does the modesty of Shaul have to do with tznius of Rachel? They're two completely unrelated topics. Yet the Gemara says in one breath, the tznius of Rachel, the tznius of Shaul, the tznius of Esther, all the same, when they're clearly different. When Rachel exhibited tznius, which means very, very private regards for certain issues, and Shaul has nothing to do with that. He was a modest man who didn't want to brag. What connection do the two have to one another? And to answer this, I think we need to fundamentally understand this concept called tznius. And to do that, I want you to imagine the following. Imagine you're at a wedding, and imagine that it's on the woman's side, and in walks a woman, dressed to kill, fashionable to the nth degree. Everything matches. Everything is gorgeous. The most sophisticated fashion, and granted, a bit too tight, but every head turns, everyone notices this woman. And they also notice, look how tzanua she is. Look, clearly, skirt down below the knees, sleeves below the elbow, neck bone fully covered. What a tzanua woman. Wonderful. Except one problem. That woman is not exhibiting tznius at all. And not only is she not exhibiting tznius, a very interesting thing happens. You see, when a woman walks in and her intention is to draw attention to herself, that people should look at her, that she should make a fashion statement, she should make an impression, she should make a grand entrance, that is the exact opposite of tznius. The word sneus, properly translated, and it's a little bit mysterious how people don't realize this, the word sneus refers to the midah of modesty. Modesty means humility. Humility means I don't want to be the center of attention. I don't want people looking at me. I don't want to be known. I'm a humble, simple person. It happens to manifest itself in a woman in a certain regards. When a woman dresses in a tsanua manner, in a manner of a modest woman, she doesn't draw attention to herself. She's uncomfortable in the limelight. She's uncomfortable with people looking at her. She's uncomfortable being the center of attention. And a woman who is tsnius is a woman who is humble and because of her humility doesn't want to draw attention to herself. Granted, there are certain halachas. Granted, there are certain specific halachic guidelines and requirements. But if you'd like to understand the concept of tsnius is modesty. I don't want people looking at me. Certainly, I don't want them looking at me in the wrong way. I don't want to draw attention. I'm a humble, simple person. And ironically, it's something that's innate, inborn to women. A woman by nature is a tsnua. And if you'd like to watch this woman when she walks into that room and all heads turn, all eyes are fixed upon her, a very interesting thing happens. On one level, she's extremely happy. Look at me. Everyone's looking at me. Everyone's paying attention to me. Everyone notices my every step, my every movement. Look at that. I'm in the center of the world with all eyes upon me. And one part of her is ecstatic. One part of her is very, very happy. But there's another part of her that is miserable. She, as every other human being on the planet, is an neshama from up high, a pure, holy neshama put into this world to accomplish, to grow. And within her, there's a voice that screams out, ugh, everybody's looking at me. Everyone's staring at me. Why are they all gawking and looking at me? And especially the men, look at the eyes. Look how they're looking at me. Ugh, I feel dirty. I feel disgusting. And while a woman may not focus on this because one part of her says, wow, look at me, how good it feels to be the center of attention, there's another part of her that feels miserable, feels extremely uncomfortable, feels like, ugh, I want to escape. And if you'd like to know why it is that the women who put glamour and fashion as the first and primary mode of existence and importance in life are not happy, a big part of the reason is because they're running against their very nature. The nature of a woman is to be tsanua, to be modest. But again, it doesn't mean necklines and sleeve lengths. It means modest. I don't want to be the center of attention. I don't want to be in everyone's mouth or everyone's eye. I'm a simple, humble person. A woman by nature is tsanua. And when she draws attention to herself, when she specifically acts in a provocative, eye-catching manner, what she's doing is she's running against her very teva, against her very nature, and she will suffer. She may enjoy it now, it may feel good, but there's an inner tension, an inner conflict, and inside there's tremendous amount of misery that she's causing to herself. And it comes out weeks later, months later, when she just isn't happy and just isn't, oh, just glamorous lifestyle. Picture on the front cover of every newspaper, of every magazine, and miserable at the core of my existence. And the point of this discussion is not whether a person should yearn to have their picture on People magazine or Glamour magazine. The point here is far more specific, and that is understanding that sneus is about modesty, which is a midah, a character trait of humility. I'm uncomfortable being in the center. I'm uncomfortable having people look at me. It's not the nature of a woman. And the reason why one of the focuses of a woman is tsnius is because that's her nature, and that's her way, and that in fact is what the Gemara is telling us. Do you know why Rachel was uncomfortable saying that there was simonim? It's not modest. These are private things. Tsnius stems from modesty. There are certain things that a husband and wife do that are kaddish, that are holy, that are beautiful, that build a bond of love and attachment, that bring the Shekhinah closer, that are maybe amongst the holiest things imaginable, but those things are extremely private. And it's for no one else to know, but not just for no one else to know, for no one else to know anything about it. And a modest woman is extraordinarily uncomfortable. That's between me and my husband, but for no one else's eyes, no one else's ears. And the reason why she didn't want the fact that Yaakov had given her simonim out there was because, at the core of her essence, it wasn't humble, it wasn't modest, it wasn't private, it didn't belong to be known. And that is exactly why Shaul didn't want the fact out that he was king, because he was a humble man. Granted, he was melech, granted, he was fit for that position, but as a very humble man, he didn't want the honor, didn't want the kavod, and didn't want to mention it. He was a humble man, and tznius in the midah, in the character trait of humility, is tznius in a woman. One time it manifests itself in terms of not wanting to be the center of attention by dressing provocatively. Another time it manifests itself in a man in not wanting to brag, not wanting to be enjoy honor. But it's the same midah, the midah of humility. And I believe this concept is fundamental for the discussion of marriage in general, of people being happy, and how to have a successful marriage. As we've mentioned before, there is a very specific formula that Chazal give us for Shalom Bayis. If you follow the formula, it is guaranteed you will have a beautiful marriage, happy, joyous, harmonious. If you follow the formula and follow the system, you'll have a beautiful home. And what is the formula? Rambam, Hilchos Ishus, Perek Tezvav, says, Tzivu Chachamim, our Chachamim commanded a man to mechabed es ishto yosu migufo. The husband has to honor his wife more than himself, v'ohavo kegufo, and love her as he does himself. Respect first, love second. The obligation of the husband is to say to himself, I have to honor my wife. I have to treat her with respect, with accord. I have to treat her with tremendous regard. He has to treat her with more honor than he does himself, and he has to love her as he does himself. V'chein, so too says the Rambam, Sivu Chachamim al Isha. So too Chazal commanded the woman, Shetei mechabedes es baila biyoser, that she should treat her husband with exceeding honor, and he should be to her literally almost like a sire, almost like a king. She should say to herself, what could I do to please him? What could I do to make him happy? If a husband treats his wife with respect and love, and a wife treats her husband with exceeding respect and asks, what could I do to please him? You are guaranteed to have a beautiful, beautiful marriage, Shalom Bayis, and everything will be perfect. So here's the question. Everyone wants a beautiful marriage. Certainly every chassan and kala, as they walk down that aisle, expect to live happily ever after. And it's such an easy formula. So why is it that we have so many issues, problems, troubles, and especially today? So I'd like to focus a little bit on why the formula is easy conceptually, but in terms of practically applying it, isn't always as easy as you might think. And let's start with the following observation. Those who really understand science tell us that the most significant words in science, in any discovery in the history of science, is not the expression, Eureka, I've found it. Mm-mm. The most significant expression that brings about all revolutions, all new discoveries in science, is the words, that's strange. You see, Eureka is the discovery. But the discovery only comes after seeing, something doesn't make sense here. The principles, the tenets that I've always accepted don't seem to add up. Something is strange. And when you find something is strange and you apply a scientific method, you remain objective, and then you step outside and calculate very cautiously, and you ask yourself the whys, and you experiment, eventually you get to the Eureka. I've discovered the answer. But it all begins with that first step, this is strange. And I'd like to share with you, many people will tell you that there are important words that you must always say in a marriage. You must always say, I love you. You must always be ready to say, I'm sorry. And I agree, those words are very important. If you do not on a regular basis tell your spouse, I love you and mean it, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And if you're not prepared on a regular basis to say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I hurt your feelings, and it is my mistake, and there is no excuse, you're also going to be in a lot of trouble. And those words are very, very important. I love you, and I'm sorry. But at the same time, I'd like to share with you that there are some other words that are also important, and maybe as important, maybe even more important, and that is the words, that's strange. Why in the world did she react that way? Why in the world did he get so angry? I don't understand it. I just said this, and all of a sudden, he got all huffy and puffy and started, why? I don't understand it. And those words, it's strange. If you train yourself to ask those questions and train yourself to figure out the answers, you will save yourself from an awful lot of trouble in a marriage. And I'll explain to you why. The common parlance, common expression, women, they're all crazy. Every young guy says, women, they're all crazy. And typically the women say, men, they're all abusive. They have no feelings, they have no emotions. And that's how it goes. Men say women are crazy. Women say men are abusive and everything is fine and everything is dandy. And that is one of the problems that often surfaces in a marriage. Because that type of attitude, while may be cute and may make it into the comics and may make for good jokes about mother-in-laws, can be devastating in a marriage. And I'll share with you why. Imagine we have a fellow and gets married. He's a reasonable guy, you know, marries a nice enough girl. And not long after the marriage, she starts crying. And he says to her, why are you crying? And she explains. And he says to himself, oh my goodness, she's gotta be kidding me. That's why she's crying? I'm going to set this straight right now. We're going to get this straight from the beginning. We're not going to have any crybabies. We're not going to have any of this stuff. And in fact, he explains to her right from the beginning why what she's crying about is wrong. She shouldn't cry anymore. And he's very satisfied that he's done a good job of straightening his wife out and he's begun his marriage in the right way. And unfortunately, what he doesn't realize is he's doing one of the most damaging, destructive things to his marriage. I'll explain to you why. Bar Mitzvah says, Amarav l'olam ye'odam zohir bonos ishto. A man should always be very, very careful with the oppression of his wife. A man should always be careful with what he says. Be careful with the words, be careful with the tone, because shemitoch shedimosa mitzvah, because she cries easily, onosa krova, her oppression is easier. Would you like to know what this Gemara is saying? What this Gemara is saying is, men, you got it dead wrong. Women do not cry because they're crybabies. Women cry because they're in pain. Women don't cry because while they're crying about nothing, it's that they feel much more intensely, in a much more real manner, the emotions, and what they're crying about is real. If you have the attitude, my wife is a crybaby, she cries over nothing, number one, you're mistaken. Ask a woman who's gone through childbirth. Ask a woman who's brought up kids if women aren't tough. It would be foolhardy to assume, yeah, men are tough, women are a bunch of wimps. The difference between a man and a woman in this regard is that women's emotions are much more prominent, much more sensitive, and she feels things in a much more real way than does a man. And the reason why she cries is not because she's a crybaby or she's a wimp. It's because she has emotions that are real, that get hurt. I have four daughters and they always say, guys have no emotions. And there's some truth to it. Women are far more emotional. They feel more. They cry more. They laugh more. Just bring out a picture of a baby. Ooh! And all the guys are, oh my goodness, it's a crumbly. What are you... Women are much more emotional, and when they cry, it's not because they're crybabies, it's because they're feeling those emotions more intensely. And the nafgamina is very real. You see, if a husband's attitude is, my wife, kind of cry, baby. I'm going to straighten her out. What he's saying to her in very clear words are, your feelings are invalid. You, as a person, that which you're experiencing has no validity, is improper, and I'm not glorious it. I give it no credit. And what she hears from her husband is that he's a creep. He's a selfish, self-centered, callous creep who doesn't care about what she's going through because she's in pain and she feels her pain and she's crying because she's in pain. And not only doesn't he come over and say, "Oi, how could I help you?" He looks at her and says, "You're a nut. What's with you crying over that little nothing? I'm crying because I'm in pain." And when he says that's nothing, he's negating her feelings. He's putting her down. And what he's doing is he's forcing her away, distancing her in a very real way. And when you find your wife crying and you say, it doesn't make sense, what you have to then say is, uh-oh, it's time for me to wisen up. It's time for me to climb into her emotional realm, for me to climb into her world, and for me to ask myself, what is she feeling? That's strange. I wouldn't cry if that were happening to me. Why is she crying? And the difference between doing that and having the typical, women are crazy, guys are abusive, is oftentimes the difference between a successful marriage and a failure. I can't tell you how many times young couples have come, whether it be to my office or to a marriage therapist, or just speak to someone who deals with the issues, and you have a loving couple. He loves her. She loves him. And they can't get along. They're at each other's throats. They're fighting, scratching, clawing like cats and dogs. They're just at each other all day. And they can't figure out why. And one of the great secrets is that you have to be open-minded and you have to be able to say the words, that's strange, now let me go figure it out. Not to be dismissive, not to be crazy. I'll train her, I'll teach her, because that's destructive, it's damaging, it's not fair, and it is a guaranteed way that you're going to cause a lot of trouble. And in this regard, in regard to emotions, men and women both have a little bit of an education that they need to gather. When a husband sees his wife crying, he has to say to himself, that's strange, now let me figure out why. And when a wife sees her husband acting callous to her tears, she has to say to herself, that's strange. Why is he acting like a lout? Why is he acting like a callous creep? He has to learn and she has to learn. He has to learn that those emotions are legitimate and real and she's really experiencing them. And on the flip side, she has to look at her husband and say, I get it. It's not that he's mean, not that he's cruel, not that he's callous. He doesn't have the same emotions. And part of my goal, part of my role as a wife, is to A, understand that. The reason he's reacting that way is not because he's mean, but because he doesn't have those same emotions. And B, let me help him understand who I am. But not by getting angry, not by criticizing, not by name-calling, by later on, not b'shas ma'isa, explaining what you're feeling, what you were going through, and what you felt when your husband reacted that way. The problem comes in with this dismissive attitude. She's crazy. He's a creep. And because of that, no one is looking at the inner goings on. No one is understanding the other. And I'd like to share with you, if you ever want to get to the bottom of a fight in a marriage, you'll never get there. He said, then she said, then he said, then he said. If by the time they come into my office, if you would try to trace back the punches and kicks and kicks and punch and where it all started, I'd like to share with you all of it. All of it is irrelevant. It's never about the issue. It's about the feelings. It's about the feelings of acceptance, the feelings of love, or the opposite. Every fight in a marriage has to do with the fact that the husband or the wife feels pushed away, feels rejected, feels hurt. Here is my best friend, here's my confidant, here's my lover who just dealt me such a harsh blow. Ouch, it hurts. It's not the words she said, it's my hurt feelings. And it's never the words. And every time someone tries to say, you shouldn't say this, you should say this, do say that, do say that, you missed the boat. The question is the emotions, the feelings. Why did she react that way? She reacted that way because she felt that you were cruel, that you were callous, that you didn't care. She felt instead of one who supported her and loved her, that you want to push her away. Why did your husband get so reactive when you started complaining, you don't care about me? You know why? Because he didn't understand that it really hurt you. And because he didn't understand that, and then you go and complain, and all you do is complain and carp and complain and carp, and before you know it, he wants out. Get me out of here. All she does is kvetch and carry on. I want nothing to do with this. And if husband and wife don't study each other, don't learn the emotionality of the other, they are guaranteed to have a lot of trouble. It is true that the first role in Shalom Bayis is to respect your spouse, to love your spouse, and there has to be a powerful bond of love, and there has to be a lot of time spent in romantic love, and time spent giving each other attention, and time spent respecting each other. But if you're not going to learn the inner workings one of the other, you are destined to fail. Why? Because inadvertently, you're going to cause such pain, such hurt. There's never the pain dealt in any human relation that's dealt in a marriage. This is your closest relation, the one upon whom you rely, the one who you supposedly love and supposedly loves you back, and that's the way they acted in such a cruel manner. And if you don't study your spouse without knowing it, without meaning it, you're going to cause a lot of damage and a lot of trouble. And with that as an introduction, let's focus on what I'd like to take from this chazal. You ever notice that men and women seem to have the same kind of complaints over and over and over? If you walk into a Rav's study, you walk into a marriage therapist's office, you'll hear again and again the same patterns. All I want to do is spend time with her. I want to do things with her. And all she wants to do is talk and talk and talk and talk. I don't get it. I don't understand it. She drives me crazy. I want to go out and spend a nice day together, and all she wants to do is talk. Would you like to understand why that is? Here's an interesting fact. Tom Houston, a psychologist at University of Texas, studies couples in depth. And he studied a few hundred couples, 264 couples to be exact. And what he found was that the way men and women rate the satisfaction level, how happy they are in the marriage, is based on different things. What he found was, this was studying 264 couples who were happily married, the women, almost to a woman, almost all of them rated the key criteria for a good marriage is good communication. That's what all the women said. But guess what? Very few of the men rated that significant at all, most number five. And isn't that strange that most women will tell you that intimacy means talking things over, especially talking about the relationship itself? What woman doesn't want to talk about how our relationship is unfolding, how it's developing? And most guys look at the wife and go, let's be married. We don't have to talk about being, we'll be married. It's good enough. Isn't that strange? And let's focus on the why behind this. And to do this, I think we have to study boys and girls at a much younger age and try to tease out their very nature, their very teva, the different manners in which Hashem created them. If you go to a schoolyard and you watch boys and girls at play, you'll find that the boys and the girls play in a very different way. Their games are different, the groups are different. Certainly by the time they reach maybe 5, 6, 7 years of age, for sure, they're not playing it all together. The girls will be off to the side playing in small, intimate groups. The emphasis on all the games is there shouldn't be hostility, they should all cooperate. The boys will typically be in larger groups, and the emphasis is on competition. And if you're not sure that I'm right, just watch what happens when a child gets hurt. When a boy gets hurt in a game, it's expected for him to get out of the way, stop crying, so the game can go on. In fact, if a boy starts crying and stops the game, he's called a sissy, he's called all kinds of names, and he's like, what's your problem? When a girl's playing a game and she gets hurt, everyone stops. Are you okay? Are you okay? And if you study the games that they play, And you'll find that boys take this kind of pride, this lone, tough-minded independence and autonomy, and girls see themselves as a web of connectiveness. Why is this? The reason is because Hashem put in the teva of a woman a need for social connections. To a woman, friendships and social attachments are essential. Women typically rate themselves by how many good friends they have, whether they have a best friend or not. Their friendships, one supporting the other supporting one, are essential to what they are as people. Listen to women when they talk in the restaurant. They talk about intimate, very detailed parts of their lives. Listen to guys talking, they're talking about things and stocks and bonds and whatever. As an example, one of my daughters went to a camp where the older girls, the counselors, were very involved and became mentors. There's a beautiful culture in the camp, and the counselors became friends and mentors to the younger girls, and they formed real attachments. And it happened when my daughter was about 14, she went to the wedding of one of her counselors, and I found out after that at the wedding, it looked like Tisha B'Av. When the counselor was getting married, she's, you know, walking down the aisle, all these 14-year-old girls who were invited, these were, you know, this was her, their mentor, their good friend. When she was getting married, they were crying, but not tears of joy, tears of terrible, terrible pain because their best friend was leaving them. Now she's going to be married. She has a husband. Obviously, we can't have the same relationship anymore because she's leaving me. And in fact, it became such an issue that in camp the next year, they had to have an entire program. How do we deal with those type of attachments? Women attach one to another. Women create friendships. Women create bonds. Those bonds are essential for their happiness, for their satisfaction. It's in the teva, the nature of a woman, to be caring, to be nurturing, to be giving. And if she's not, she's very down. Guys are very different. Guys, they're nice guys, they're good guys, but the attachments, the needs for social bonding, the cliques, the friendships don't quite exist. One more example, when my daughter was, I think she was 16 years old, one of my daughters came home and she said that two of her friends weren't in school that day. I said, why not? She said, well, they were having a DMC last night. I said, what? What's a DMC? Oh, you know, Haba, DMC, a deep, meaningful conversation. They were up till 3 o'clock in the morning having a deep, meaningful conversation, so they couldn't come to school the next day because they were exhausted. I taught high school boys for about 15 years. I never once saw two guys sharing their inner secrets, their inner thoughts, connecting on the level of deep conversation. It just doesn't happen. Because men and women are different. Women have a need for social connections, and men don't. And that difference manifests itself in marriage in a very interesting way. Women read romance novels. Women magazines deal with these type of things. From the time a girl is 13 years old, all she's dreaming about is her wedding and being married, and it'll be great, I'll have a best friend, but a best friend who's always there for me, he'll support me, and together we'll have this awesome relationship, and it's going to be unbelievable, wow. And then she gets married. And guess what? It's not quite what she thought it was going to be. I mean, first of all, he doesn't talk. And second of all, he doesn't get me. And he doesn't understand me. And he's always saying the wrong kind of thing. I mean, he's a nice guy and everything, but like, he's like always when I'm talking and I'm sharing, he's jumping all over the place. And I don't know. It's not working out. The Stipe Lagon in a letter writes something so powerful. He says, and I'll translate it into English, the main hope of a woman, tikva sa'isha, in her world, in her life, is to have a husband who loves her. When she sees that this isn't so, it crushes her spirit and can be close to pikuach nefesh. What a woman needs in a marriage is a close confidant, a spouse who loves her, and when she knows that her husband respects her, that he loves her, when she knows that her husband is someone who supports her, who's with her, then she's filled, she's happy, and if not, says the Stipe, it's close to pikuach nefesh. And a husband's role, interestingly enough, is to provide that support for his wife. The Chazon Ish writes something very, very powerful in his letter. It says the Chazon Ish, Lo di b'yitzil anhu holich. He has to tell his wife when he's leaving where he's going to, ubeshuvo, and when he returns, what he did. Why does he have to say that? You ever notice that? Women will always say, how was your day? And men almost never say it. Women say to their husbands or to their friends, how was your day? Because they want to connect. They want to share the experience. What did you go through today? We haven't been together in over 8 hours. What was your day like? I want to share it with you. I want to be there with you. Women have that need. Men don't. And if a man takes the attitude of, whatever, come on, you know, I went to yeshiva today and learned the nutosis. I made some money today, bought some stuff. Come on. Don't get crazy on me. Come on, what did I do today? Whatever, I did some stuff. What man? Let's get back to business. What he's doing is he's crushing his wife. Her inner need he's not meeting. And the role of a husband is to uncover and understand his wife's needs, not to be dismissive, not to be just whatever crazy woman, to uncover her needs and to provide for those emotional needs. And that means, as the Chazon Ish says, he has to talk with her. He has to uncover and he has to speak what it is that she needs, what it is that she wants. More than anything, what she needs is to attach, to feel that someone cares, that someone connects. And the way she does that is by giving support and being supported. When a wife knows that her husband genuinely cares, that he's concerned, that he's worried, where were you today? What were you involved in? What happened? What was your day like? When a husband asks a wife those questions, what she understands in very clear terms is he cares about me. He genuinely holds me in deep regard. And when he doesn't ask those questions, and he's not concerned, and he's not willing to talk about it, in her emotional world, what she hears is he doesn't give a darn. And you can tell her from today till tomorrow, come on, it's just the guys are different, men are different. It's not going to help. Because those words are in the intellectual realm, in her heart of hearts, in her emotional reality, she gets it very clearly. You don't care about her. And a husband has to learn what's important to his wife. He has to study her needs. Some women need more, some less, some in this way, some in that way. No two human beings are the same. Every human being is unique. And while we can discuss general principles of men and women, etc., each spouse is unique in their own right. And every husband has to study his wife, understand what she needs, and his job is to provide that. And in this regard, the woman also has a role to play. A wife has to understand that her husband has a different emotional basis than she does. And she has to understand that he doesn't have this need to talk. And he doesn't have this need to share. And he doesn't have this need to connect in that way. He's very happy with you if he's learning on his side and you're with him. If he's gardening and you're with him, he's happy, he's connecting. And a wife has to understand that. She also has to express her needs. She has to gently, and again, not at the moment, not when she's angry and not when he's making a mistake. At a different time, she has to explain what her needs are and why it's not enough for her. And they have to find a balance. But as long as both are open, both are looking, what are my spouse's needs? My spouse is different. And when I see a reaction that doesn't make sense, I train myself to say, that's strange. Why is he acting that way? I know he's a nice guy. Why doesn't he care about what I did today? Why doesn't he ask me where I went? Why doesn't he ask me when I'll be back? I don't get it. And if a wife says, he's a crazy guy, and starts nagging and bothering and demeaning and just starts going off, what she's going to find is she's going to make it very difficult for her husband to learn her needs, very difficult for her husband to like her. And I'd like to share with you something for young kalas to remember. Every young kala has this dream. I'm going to get married, and it's going to be my best friend 24/7. I won't even need my girlfriends anymore. All my friends who I used to talk to, I won't even need them anymore. One of the biggest mistakes that a young kala can make is to give up her girlfriends. Why? because your husband does not have the same emotionality as does a young woman. Your husband doesn't have the same needs, and you will not connect to your husband in the same way as you do to your friends. And you must keep your friends. You keep your friends to talk about things. You keep your friends to share things, to offer support, not about your marriage. That's private. That's personal. But everything else about life. And don't bother your husband with emotional needs that you can satisfy outside with other people who will do a better job. Your husband is your best friend. Your husband is your confidant. But your husband is a different sort of person than are your girlfriends. And all of those things that you share, keep your friends, speak with them, recognize your husband's needs, recognize his tolerance level, and recognize that he doesn't speak for hours and hours. And if you have those needs, make sure you use other people as your friends to do that. When a husband understands his wife, and when a wife understands her husband, and together they work on respect and love, the Rambam's formula comes true. But again, the key point is you have to study the needs, study the requirements, and understand them. And this difference between emotional needs and social connections surfaces in another very interesting way that typically men and women don't quite understand. Men's relationships one with another are different than our women. Women typically are on the same level. Women are very comfortable, all with the same first names, all friends, all peer-to-peer relationships. Most relationships in the male world are hierarchical. There's a teacher and a student. There's a policeman and people he watches. There's a boss and their employees. Most relationships in a male world have a hierarchy where one is above and the other is below. Men are very competitive. Watch boys at play. There's always the dominant alpha male, the best ball player, the most powerful guy, and he's the one who's respected. He's the one who's looked up to. The world of the male is far more competitive, and their relationships are far more hierarchical with one or the other being in charge. Watch little boys when they're at play. They're very comfortable dressing up as the policeman, telling everyone where to go, the fireman in charge, etc. And that difference manifests itself in a very, very interesting way. What happens when the first Matzah Shabbos, they're married, and the Shev Bracha is over, and the first Matzah Shabbos said it's Nogea, the guy goes out to play ball, and he forgets to tell his young wife. And he comes back to the apartment, and she's crying. And for the life of him, he can't figure it out. Dear, I'm sorry. Why are you so upset? Okay, I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you. Sorry. You left me. And she's breaking up. She's mom is losing it. He looks at her like she has lost her sanity. And she looks at him like the biggest creep who ever walked the face of the planet. And I'd like to share with you the why behind each of their reactions. The reason she is so devastated is because she thrives. She lives on attachment. How could you leave without telling me where you're going? Just separate yourself. Just left my world. You just walked out. He is used to a relationship where if you have to answer to somebody, they're your boss. And when she demands that wherever he goes, he gives her an accounting, and he has to tell her, and he's going to be late, and she's always nagging him, why didn't you tell me, and why didn't you tell me you're going out? Once he hears that she's trying to control me. When he doesn't tell her, she feels he's trying to separate, he's trying to like walk away, he's trying to unconnect. And when she asks him, and she forces him to tell where he goes and what he does, he feels that she's trying to be above him, trying to control him. And it's very interesting because, again, when you get the marriages spinning out of control, that's what you hear. Where over and over the guy says, she's controlling and she's dominant. She's trying to boss me around and tell me where to go and where to go. And she's crying. He just doesn't care. He doesn't care about me. And he's not interested in me. And again, it stems from this very basic difference in terms of social relationships. You see, women connect to one another in a very peer-to-peer manner, And when one woman says to another, where are you going? She's expressing concern and care. What a man hears in those words from his world is a very different message. Someone's trying to be my boss. What are you, my mother? What are you, my cop? You're trying to control me? And both have to learn that the emotionality of their spouse is legitimate, proper, and right. He needs his space. And he also has to recognize that she can't feel rejected. So he's got to learn to say the words, dear, I'm going out. Dear, I'll be late. And he's got to recognize that she has a real need for connection. And on the flip side, she has to recognize that when he messes up, which he will do, because that's his nature, he's not perfect yet. And when he messes up, she has to be willing to say, I get it. It's not because he's rejecting me, not because he's pushing me away, but because he's not comfortable. And my job is not to nag him. My job is not to complain. And you'll find these differences surfacing in a lot of different situations. Guys will invite people over for a Shabbos. Three of his buddies are in, so he invites him for a Shabbos meal and doesn't tell his wife. Not because he's callous, and not because he's a creep, but you know why? I got to tell everything. I got to ask permission. What am I like? I can't even run my own life. I need permission to go out. I need permission to come in. I need permission who to invite and who not to invite. Why does he feel that way? He feels that way because women connect. And when one woman shows concern for another, it's a very good feeling. And if a woman says, I can't go out tonight without first speaking to my best friend, she's sharing a sense of pride. I have such a close friend that I can't just walk out. And when a guy says, I can't walk out tonight without asking permission from my boss, from the one who's in charge of me, he feels demeaned. He feels put down. What is she, my police woman over here? I got to answer to somebody? I'm a free, independent person. And what I'd like to share with you is that this is the very nature of a woman and a man. You see, what Rachel was demonstrating was tznius. A woman by nature is modest, but not modest because she covers up. Modest because she has much less ego. A male's ego is very, very susceptible to damage. A woman has much less ego, much less guy of a problem. And as a result, it's easier for a woman to connect, and she doesn't feel dominated when she answers to somebody else. She doesn't feel someone's controlling when that someone expresses concern for their well-being. But a man does. And a woman has to recognize that a male ego is different than is her own ego. And a man has to recognize that a woman's ego is different than his. And women, I'd like to share with you a very significant piece of advice. When you are walking next to your husband, always remember firmly in your brain that I'm dealing with a very, very delicate ego. If you're smarter than your husband, don't let him know it. If you can disprove your husband or argue with him, don't let him know it. His ego is very sensitive, and it's 100% true that the male ego is inflated. The male ego is sensitive, different levels, different people. But bederech klal, a woman is more tzenua, not just covering up, but has less of an ego, and a man has more. And just as a man has to be very careful because there's a heart of his wife that's very delicate and very sensitive to pain, a woman has to be sensitive to the ego of her husband. And I don't mean it in a pejorative, and I'm not putting men down here, but if a woman is not going to be sensitive to the ego of her husband, she is going to be one miserable human being. Because all you got to do is hit that ego once, twice, a few times too many, and he's going to become, against his will, he's going to become a different human being. I've seen it time after time after time where nice guys, people are mentioned, become chaya ra. They become vicious, biting. And it's really quite simple. She didn't know how to handle a husband. She didn't know how to handle a man. And she said things and did things and bothered him and asked and said things in a way that caused him a lot of pain. And when you pain a person and hurt him, you don't have a right to say, well, don't have a big ego, you bald guy for you. The same way he doesn't have a right to say, don't be a crybaby, because your feelings are valid And when you feel pain, it's real. If you hit his ego, I guarantee he's going to feel pain and you're the one who's going to suffer. And if I had a word of advice, I would say, husbands, understand that when you walk with your wife, when you speak to your wife, when you deal with your wife, always remember there's a very sensitive heart. Make sure your words are careful. Make sure your words are soft. Make sure that you're very, very cautious in what you do and how you do it, because there's a heart that's so delicate, that's way more sensitive to you than yours, and you could cause us such pain. And it would also tell the women, make sure that you always remember that there's an ego there. And if you say the wrong line in the wrong way, and you look like you're nagging and complaining and carping and criticizing and telling him what he did wrong and what he could do better, and even if you mean it from the best ways, even if you mean it because you can make him better and you can improve him, what you're doing is you're hitting at a very, very sensitive part of him. You're going to cause him a lot of pain, and the reactions can get very, very ugly. So if we take something from this chazal, the difference between the woman being by nature more tsanua, more modest, more humble, less egotistical, and the man being more, I think these lessons are important. Number one, understanding that women have different needs in the relationship, that a woman thrives on her husband's attention, thrives on her husband's looking out for her needs, but not just looking out for her needs by providing parnasa, bread on the table, looking out for her emotional needs by asking her how a day is, by sharing things. That's how a woman connects. And a husband has to worry about the need that a wife has for love and approval. And the way she gets that is by him showering attention, speaking to her, showing her that he holds her in high regard, not by buying her expensive presents, but by meeting her emotional needs, letting her know that she's number one in his world, by asking, by being involved in her world, by showing that her issues are key to him. And a woman has to understand that a man doesn't have the same need for social connections. He doesn't have the same need for relationship, and therefore she has to recognize that when he doesn't ask or he's not interested in speaking about it, that's not his nature, and don't get offended. It's not that he doesn't love you, not that he just doesn't have the same needs and doesn't express it the same way. You have to educate him very gently. You have to explain what your needs are. Not at the time, not b'shas ma'isa, but later on, you say to him, you know, I just want to share. It would make me so happy if you were to do this and this. I'd really enjoy it if we were to talk about this and this. And you explain to him why, because that's what's important to me. And that's what lets me know that you care about me. And that's what lets me know that you love me. You're not carping. You're not complaining. You're not kvetching. You say it once nicely, twice at most, and then you quiet down. And you don't say it again and again and again and again and again and again until he gets so angry that he just loses it. You say it, not at the time, say it once, nicely, maybe twice, and explain what you're going through. And you have to recognize that he'll sometimes remember, not always, and it doesn't mean anything other than the fact that right then he's not there, right then he's not having the same needs, and he's not quite connecting to you in that way. And also, men and women have to remember that the social needs manifest themselves differently in terms of the issue of dominance, in terms of equal relationships. Women create these peer-to-peer relationships. Men create hierarchical relationships. And a woman has to be very careful not to make it feel to her husband that she's controlling him. Husband has to recognize that he can't be independent. His wife thrives on knowing that they're attached. And when he leaves without telling her, or he comes late and fails to mention it, the message that she hears loud as clear as day is, I don't care about you. We're not connected. We're not one. And that message is devastating to a woman, as the Stipler says, Kol tikva sa'isha, the entire hope of a woman is to find a husband that loves her, and what she finds is the opposite. So a husband has to recognize that. And at the same time, a wife has to recognize that when he doesn't call, or he leaves without saying, the reason he did it is not because he doesn't care, not because he's a creep, but because that's the way guys are. Does he have to work on it? Yeah. Do you have to understand him? Yeah. And that's the sort of meeting in the minds, meeting in the middle, that both parties have to do. Because you could love your spouse, you could respect them, but if you don't train yourself to say, that's strange, what's going to happen is you're going to cause a lot of damage, you're going to cause a lot of pain to your spouse. But I think there's one more step that might be even more important than everything else that we've said up to now. If you'd like to know one of the biggest obstacles to any successful marriage, it's listening to the wrong radio station. Most Americans, probably most people in Western culture, listen to the wrong radio station. It's station WIIFM. Station WIIFM is What's In It For Me? What's in it for me? What's in it for me? What do I gain from this? What am I getting? What am I benefiting? And that radio station in any relationship is devastating, and in a marriage, so much more so. And let me sort of trace for you the typical progression. Hassan and Kala, they're looking in each other's eyes, ooh, and you can almost hear the words, I love her, she loves me, we're of one mind, one unit, together forever and ever. And in his mind, that's exactly what's going to happen. He loves her, and anything she wants, he's going to gladly do. And in her mind, they're one. And anything he wants, she'll gladly do, but it doesn't matter. You know why? Because we're so unified, we're so one, that we're always going to want the same thing. We're always going to want the same green wallpaper. We're always going to want the same orange sofa. We're always going to want to live in the same neighbors. We're so one, we're so together, we're so unimined, that we'll always want the same things. And it's wonderful, and it's great. Until the Sheva Brachas are over. And then it's time to choose paint color. And he wants blue, and she wants green. And even though he says, okay, dear, you want it fine. Wait a minute, you don't want the same color as I do? No, not really. And when it's time to go to pick a parent to go to for Shabbos, let's go to my parents. Well, I'd rather go to mine. Okay, I'll do it for you, dear, but wait, you don't want to go the same as me? And Kalas probably suffer from this a little bit more than the guys do. And it's that shocking reality. You mean we're not really one? You mean you have different desires and interests and temperament and things that you want to do than me? Oh my goodness, I thought we were one and we're not really one. And usually people make a very interesting step at that point. Rather than saying we're not one, it's either the Kala or the Chassan, and sometimes both, who say we are one. And I'm the one. I've solved the problem. We're one unit. And I'm the dominant voice. We're one. And I'm the one. I'm in charge. So I pick paint color. I pick which house we go to for Shabbos. I pick what kind of foods. I pick how we serve the meals. I pick because we're one. And I'm the one. And if it sounds funny the way I'm saying it, if you watch very carefully, that's exactly what happens many, many times. The way that things have been done in my house is the normal way. The way that things are done in my, you know, in my world, that's the normal way. And, you know, my husband or my wife, they're just going to have to learn the right way. And because my way is the right way, we're one and I'm the one. I'd like to share with you one of the critical steps in the beginning stages of a marriage and in every stage in a marriage is recognizing that I'm dealing with a different human being with different desires, interests, different temperament, different entire emotional fabric, coming from a different place with a different upbringing, who views things from a vastly different lens. And if you think that two human beings are going to want the same things, you are in for a rude awakening. A husband and a wife probably couldn't be more different by nature, by temperament, by inclination. Number one, they were brought up in different households. That means everything that they've been doing till then is different. Number two, they are different genders. They have different emotional needs. And number three, they have different temperaments. Even two guys, some are shy, some are bold, some are extroverted, some are introverted. And the most single and critical ingredient to any successful human relationship is to eliminate the self-centeredness. And I'd like to share with you that it's not so simple. Why? Because before you're married, it's all about me. Listen, the first question, what's the best grade school for me? Certainly when I'm a baby, when I'm an infant, it's all about my needs and my what's good for me. When I hit grade school, what's the best school for me? What's the best Rebbe? What's the best situation? Camp, what's the best camp for me? High school, what's the best high school for me? yeshiva or seminary, what's best for me? Shidduch, what's the best shidduch for me? I get married and all of a sudden I discover, uh-oh, it's not all about me. There's another human being, and every decision that I'm going to make from now until the end of our marriage, there are two people involved. And we have different interests and needs and temperament. And oh my goodness, there's so many, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of decisions that have to be made. And I'd like to share with you that if you are self-centered, if you are the center of the universe, and the relationship focuses about you getting your needs met, you're going to suffer an awful lot in a marriage. For a marriage to work, you have to be interested in pleasing the other person, not interested in getting your way. If you use the Rambam system, it works. It's beautiful. The husband asks himself, what could I do to make my wife happy? How could I honor her? How could I meet her needs? How could I take care of her? What does she want? How could I serve her? How could I make her happy? The simechas ishto. The first year he has a mitzvah say. But throughout the marriage, a husband has to be focused on what could I do to make my wife happy? And a wife has to be focused on what could I do to make my husband happy? What are his needs? What are his requirements? How does he like his food? How does he like conversation? How does he like things in general? And if a husband and wife are each focused on the other, you have a beautiful, happy home. And if each of them are focused on WIIFM, what's in it for me, my needs, my desires, you're going to live in a Gehenim. You're going to live with fights and utter, total, disastrous marriage. Why? Because probably the single greatest turnoff in a marriage is when the husband or the wife wakes up one morning and says, I can't believe it. My wife is completely, utterly self-centered. Everything in this marriage is about her. Everything in this marriage is what she needs, what she wants, what's important to her. All she does is demand and complain her needs and her requirements and what she needs. And guess what? I don't really like her. Because someone who demands, someone who's so self-centered, someone who's so selfish is ugly in my eyes. And needless to say, that's a pretty difficult situation. And astonishingly, oftentimes young couples get into that situation, and even couples who are married quite a long time get into that situation, not because they're mean, and not because they really are self-centered, but because they're going about things wrong. The first question a husband and wife have to ask themselves in any situation is, how could I please my husband? That's the wife's question. The wife has to ask, how could I make him happy? He has to ask, how can I make her happy? And as trite as it may sound, if each of them focuses on their own needs, they'll be miserable. If each of them focuses on the needs of the other, they'll be happy. Because when someone focuses on your needs, you see that they're concerned for you, you see that they love you, and you want to give back. And the most disastrous element for a marriage is something called ego. Ego is me. It's about me. The world centers around me. I am God's gift to humanity. And if not God's gift to humanity, certainly everything in my world had better meet my needs because it's about me. And whether we realize it or not, we're brought up in a culture where that's exactly the message. It's about you. Get your needs met. And if you're not going to have your needs met, you're not going to be happy and you're not going to be satisfied. And you better make sure you demand your needs, because if you don't demand your needs, you're going to be unhappy and miserable. And just you tell your husband, you make it clear that you need this and you need that. And guess what? Let's see how successful those strategies are in marriage. Let's see how many of those marriages actually end in divorce, and even those that remain married, how happy they are. If you want to be happy, you have to focus on the needs of your spouse. I love my spouse. I have to take care of her needs. I have to focus on her needs. What could I do to make her happy? And every decision as a couple, if you focus that way, it's beautiful. It's easy. This time this way, this time that way. There is no exact formula. There is no exact right way. I'm concerned about your needs, and you're concerned about my needs, and together we're building a home, together we're serving Hashem. And I'd like to share with you one very real problem. What if you're married and you're not there yet? What if you got married and either you're newly married or you're married for a while and you really don't care that much? Well, let me share with you that something that's very, very telling. Your spouse will know it very, very quickly. Kissinger was newly appointed Secretary of State, and he met Pat Nixon at a affair of state, and he's going on and on about Nixon. Oh, what a great president, what a great leader. The president's wife looks at Kissinger and says, you haven't seen through him yet? A wife knows exactly who her husband is, and a husband knows exactly who his wife is. And if you're self-centered and the world is about you, you had better change quickly, or you're going to have a miserable marriage, or if you're married already, it's not going to get much better. And gee golly, what do you do? How do you do this difficult work? So again, the first thing is to understand your role. My role is to meet the obligations that Chazal put upon me. A husband has to respect his wife more than himself, and he has to love his wife as much as he loves himself. My obligation as a husband is to take care of the needs of my wife. That means I have to shower her with everything that she needs. She needs to know that she's cherished. She needs to know that she's loved. She needs to know that her needs are real and important. And I have to do that by studying what it is that really makes her tick. So many times a marriage falls apart because each one inadvertently doesn't focus on the needs of the other. And even if they're nice guys or nice women, be'etzim, but because they don't understand the needs of the husband or the wife, they end up hurting each other dramatically. What the stipler is telling us is, husbands, look at your wife. Know that she has a very sensitive heart. Know that she desperately craves your approval. She desperately craves the sense that you regard her, that you hold her as number one. When you have some criticism to offer, when you have a better way to do things, and you want to help your wife, and you want to explain to her the better way, know that you're damaging your marriage. Know that you're damaging your wife. Know that you're cutting right into her. Because what she hears very clearly is a message, I don't approve of you, you're not there yet. And if a wife hears from a husband, you're great, you're wonderful, you're amazing, her heart lightens. She's filled, she's happy. And as a husband must meet the needs of his wife, a wife must meet the needs of a husband. The wife has to ask, what does he need? He needs approval. Treating him with honor exceedingly. Yosemidai, as if a king, as if a prince has walked in. Why does Chazal demand that a wife treat a husband with such honor, such accord, not to argue with him, not to complain, not to carp? Because he has a very delicate ego. And if you treat that ego with kid gloves, guess what? He'll see a wife who's beautiful and wonderful, and he'll love her. And if he sees a wife who complains and kvetches and always has issues that she's bringing up and complaints and problems, he's going to see a wife who says to him the message, you are no good. I don't approve of you. I don't hold of you. And his ego will get raw and sore, and it will explode, and she will suffer. You have to study your spouse, you have to understand them, and you have to offer them what you need. Will you make mistakes along the way? I'm afraid you will. That's part of the game. But if you study your spouse and your attitude is, every time I do something and I don't understand the reaction, I say, that's strange. Let me figure out why. Slowly, slowly, you begin learning and you begin understanding. It takes a long time. It takes a tremendous amount of being mevater. But in the end, you have a marriage that's beautiful, that's harmonious, that's happy, and you love each other more and more each year. What Chazal is telling us is the nature of a woman is such, she's by nature a tzenua. And that was Rachel's great thing. She wouldn't reveal the secrets because between husband and wife, a woman by nature is tzenua. She needs different things in a relationship. Husband has to recognize that. Male ego is different. The wife has to recognize that. When each is dedicated one to the other, each one dedicated to the concept of how could I help my spouse? What could I do for them? You have a marriage that's beautiful and proper. You have a marriage that the Shekhinah is sure amongst me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, understanding, and ability to put this into practice.